Good morning and welcome to our first hour of Focus 580 this morning. I'm your host, filling in the day for David Inge, who is away. And we'll be inviting your questions throughout this hour, as usual. This morning, I am lucky enough to have three folks in from the Illinois Natural History Survey. Two of them have just helped author a book called Biologist in the Field, Stories, Tales, and Anecdotes from 150 Years of Field Biology. Not only 150 years of field biology, but I believe the 150th anniversary of the Illinois Natural History Survey. Susan Post is along with us, as well as Michael Jeppards and Joe Spencer. All three are entomologists, and over the next hour, we'll probably regale you with a few tales of what field biologists do and what the Illinois Natural History Survey is. And we'll ask you to join our conversation as well. In fact, if you'd like to do that, I'll give you some numbers now and we'll repeat them a couple of times throughout the show. The phone number to call in toll free is 800-222-9455. That's WILL at the end, or 217-333-9455. Good morning to you all. Thanks for making your way to the north end of campus.
Good morning.
Thank you.
To be here.
I went through your book last night, and I have to say it is magnificent. It's really filled with some great tales. And I think maybe I'll explain it this way. I have a book of poetry, cowboy poetry, that I read from time to time that talks about mustangs and roping calves and what mostly animal scientists and livestock folks do, just to get me back in the mood of being on the farm. I wasn't raised in the West. I was raised here in the Midwest, but it's all sorts of things that I could relate to. And while this isn't poetry, some of it's really, really well written to begin with. And you can turn to any page and pick up just whatever you want to, and hear stories of how things were, how things are, how field biologists work and live. And I guess because I work with all of you and have been in the field, my job, of course, is to report some of what you do and have been in the field with you. This was just a great living experience for me. How soon did you come up with the idea of doing the book?
You've mentioned, it's our 150th anniversary, and we wanted something sort of light and popular to just let people know what we as field biologists do. And I think it says in the introduction, you know, these are tales you tell at the water cooler, your friends, and we just wanted to let people know this is what a field biologist does.
Well, what do you do, Mike? Do you do anything? What do you do?
Oh, God. Yes. I've been a field biologist since 1973. So, you know, we worked on so many different projects. And when we started this project, as Sue said, most of these stories and tales come out after hours, after you've had a couple of beers, you know, and then things kind of like, oh, loosen up. And we came up with the idea of producing this and writing these things down for posterity. And we've sent out a email to the staff, and we were gratified with a response, because this is not the kind of writing we're used to doing. We're used to doing technical, scientific, you know, kind of jargony stuff. And so this was an interesting idea, and it was a challenge. And it varies everything from, you know, an 8-word haiku to a journal of a trip through Kyrgyzstan by some of our scientists doing the biodiversity of a Central Asian republic. So it varies greatly.
I think I read that haiku in the book. Was that yours, Joe Spencer? Maybe you could find it in the book and read it in a second, but you had a comment that you wanted to make.
But we also go back to our history, because at the beginning of each chapter we have a letter that Stephen Forbes wrote to his wife, or some comment that he made while he was in the field. So Forbes is a great part of our history, so we've even tied it into this book.
Yeah, tell us about Stephen Forbes.
Well, Forbes was sort of the father of the Natural History Survey, one of the founders of modern ecology. He was a Civil War veteran. He was a prisoner of war, you know, and when he got out, he was a self-taught biologist and ended up with an honorary degree, a PhD from University of Illinois. And he was the ultimate, you know, early 19th century, mid-19th century field biologist. And if you read his writings, it was written in grand Victorian style, but the words are still relevant today. And he's a fascinating person, a fascinating read. There's pieces of him around campus, you know, there's Forbes Hall, and buried in you know, cemetery, and there's still relatives alive of Forbes today in town. So it's kind of an interesting. It's not dim, distant history. It's pretty much living today.
So Joe Spencer, welcome this morning. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
I worked with Joe. I've watched Joe in action, which is kind of slow, actually, out in the field sometimes. Joe, right? Well, it is, but maybe you could read the haiku and we'll know more about that.
Yeah, well, I can give you a little background. Part of that being slow in the field for me is trying to pay attention to what the insects are doing. And as an insect behavior person, I'm really keyed into the activities of the insects. And sometimes it's really hard to know what an insect's doing. You can't ask them questions, so we have to have indirect ways to get information from them. If I want to know what insects have been eating, one of the best ways for me to find out is I cut them open and look inside. And that's what this haiku is about. It's a dissection haiku. And it goes like this. Vials of dead bugs, hard tools, tear soft parts away, look inside and see. And that really captures a lot of what I'm doing.
Yeah, that captures a lot. So maybe we can delve into this just a little bit, because I think people might be interested in why you were looking inside these bugs. I mean, what was it you were looking for? What did the field biologist Joe Spencer set out to do?
Well, one of the reasons I'm interested in what insects have been eating or what they've been doing is I'd like to know where they've been. It's really hard to track movements of insects, but when an insect eats a piece of plant tissue, it's inside that insect for quite a while. And so I can know where an insect has been by observing what it's been eating inside its digestive system. And so my interest in that was to track movement of beetles between cornfields and soybean fields in East Central Illinois to try to sort out the problem we had with western corn rootworms that were laying eggs in soybean fields and causing problems the next year in first-year corn. So by dissecting thousands of insects, I was able to learn where these insects had been. And I had concrete evidence that beetles I caught in cornfields had soybean tissue inside their gut. So I knew they were moving around. And that's a very hard thing to know just looking at the insect.
So you were looking for soybean tissue in these beetles. And you did something else that was really strange. I was out, because my job's to cover and report this. I've got a story somewhere from years ago now with you sitting atop a, I don't know how tall that scaffolding was.
40 feet. Yeah, we used 40-foot-tall scaffolding towers and insect nets to catch moving insects. It had always been one of our interests to know how many insects are flying in East Central Illinois, and what sort of numbers are moving around in the air. So we erected 40-foot-tall scaffolding towers, and we would stand out there on top of our patented life-risking towers, as we call them, belted in safely, of course, and catch insects in the evening from dusk until dark. And those studies were, they enabled us to get a picture of the patterns of beetle movement. And I'd have to say it's one of my favorite jobs as a survey employee is to end the day on top of a scaffold 40 foot above Champaign County, probably have the best view of the sunset.
You know, can you go and find that paragraph that describes you and Mr. Izard and how the idea came about and read it if you want, because there's some really magnificent verbiage. I think you were talking about the sun finally slipping away from the intertwined trees. It's at the very end of one of your stories, and we'll get back to you in a second. But I want to talk about some of the other things that are in this book. One of the things that I found out early after being a reporter here at the radio station and then moving to cover you folks more thoroughly as an extension reporter in Mumford Hall in the College of Aces is that extension people notoriously know where the best places to eat might be anywhere in the state. And It's uncanny. Do the two of you, are you the same way? Can you go?
One year, Ken Roberts and I and Michael, we had to go out in the field to take pictures for our book, Illinois Wilds. And we were headed to southern Illinois. We were going down and back in the same day. And for 4 hours, Ken and I talked about the memorable meals we had had at different restaurants. And, I mean, we would just keep coming back and forth, back and forth. And a couple scientists had suggested we should have done, like, our top 10 list, or everybody should have sent in something. But, you know, maybe that's for In the Field Part 2 or something.
Well, it is in here. At least one place is in here. Ma Hales.
Yeah, Ma Hales was a legendary place down in southwestern Illinois. And our field biologists, if they were had finished, you know, in an evening's work, and they were in Golconda, which is the other side of the state, which, you know, is still 60 miles away, they would drive to Ma Hales for dinner. I mean, it was that iconic a place, and it was just this family restaurant, you know, massive amounts of food given, and Ma Hale was a legend in southern Illinois, and the building is still there. Unfortunately, Ma Hales is long since demise, but we still have our scientists still speak of Ma Hales very fervently. And in the old days, you know, mid 20th century, ships, barges would stop on a river, and a crew would come in and eat at Ma Hales. It was, you know, it was that significant a place, shall we say.
Well, the numbers in the book said something like 2,700 meals or 1,500 meals would be served at a noon hour at this place. I just can't imagine.
Fried chicken, mashed potatoes, you know, corn, all the stuff that you would normally get at Grandma's house. That was Grandma Hales or Ma Hales.
Where are your favorite places to eat in the state? What are your current favorite restaurants? And I've got a few around the state. Now that I've traveled with the Extension folks for a while, I guess I qualify as one of those folks.
Well, in far southern Illinois, Sue and I always eat at Our Place in Karnak.
Ooh, don't know that one.
And it's kind of like going back in time to go there. You know, that's great food, great people, you know. And if you walk in, you're like, ooh, you know, this is kind of an odd place.
Well, but she opens it up for when we do our field classes. She does. She caters for us. I can't say enough about Our Place. And everybody says, well, we're going to eat at Our Place. And they're like, Mike and Sue, you're cooking for us? And we're like, no, that's the name of the restaurant, Our Place.
Yep. And it's right next to the old logging facilities in the Cache River. So it's kind of a iconic, symbolic place also.
Hey, tell me about the Cache River, because I'll bet a lot of people don't know about the Cache River Basin.
Oh, yeah.
Illinois has
one of 18 Ramsar sites, which are World Heritage Sites for wetlands in the U.S. and then across the country. And Illinois has one of them, and it's the Cache River Valley. And it's get on I-57 at exit 238 here, and you get off at exit 18, and you're there. And, you know, and it's a wonderful area of cypress
swamps. That's a long way from here to there.
It's a long way. It's a short four-hour drive. So, but it, you know, it's one of the most significant places in Illinois. It's certainly the most beautiful place in Illinois, and I grew up in that area, so I have a great fondness for the Cache.
And it has a cypress.
Cypress, tupelo forest.
Accessible by boardwalk.
Extensive wetlands, but it's one of these places you have to, it's like seeing finding a snake on a road, a really large snake, and you have to find pieces of it, you know, because it's a corridor, and you can't just go down the Cache. You have to find little bits and pieces. So it's a trek to find it, but has a wonderful new visitor center down there, and it's just a wonderful place. One of our field biologists, who unfortunately didn't write for the book, has been doing research there for 16 years on prothonotary warblers, and he has probably one of the largest data sets on birds in the country. So he uses milk cartons that have been sprayed brown, and everybody who's ever been to Cache has seen them, because he puts out like 1,200 of them, checks them twice a week through the swamp.
He has some good tales to tell.
Yes.
Oh, my Lord.
Yes, we're going to have to pin him down and make him write him up.
And that's the thing about being a field biologist is I suppose you enjoy your work to begin with, but it's the tales afterwards, and you've captured some of those in this book here that really make being a field biologist fun after the fact. I guess I can say it that way. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. As Sue wrote in part of the introduction, the worst day in the field is better than the best day in the lab.
Well, it depends on whether you're sucking bugs at that point or not.
Yeah. Yeah, but when we went, as Todd's referring to, one of the jobs he watched me perform was we worked on the biological control of purple loosestrife. And what we did was we collected insects to send to the northern parts of Illinois that had purple loosestrife infestations. And we fondly called that sucking bugs. And we would get anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 insects a day. But what he probably didn't know was that we had a bug tote board. And for every 10,000 we got, we would visit the custard cup here in town. So,
so after you suck 10,000 bugs up into a little tube,
you got to custard cup.
Maybe we probably had to explain what that looked like, too, because it was quite the apparatus that you use for a collection of these little insects.
Right. The tube is, maybe about a half inch diameter vinyl tube that was connected to two metal.
With a little vial in between, so you weren't actually the vial in between you and the bug, so that it went in a vial, not in your mouth.
Yeah, right. We had a gas filter so that would filter some of the frass, so that you didn't inhale that.
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, it was looked like something you might use with an aquarium. The tube did.
Yes, it did.
The clear plastic, and then you'd. Mm-hmm. I don't remember where the bugs were housed to begin with, but you'd reach in and you'd be.
You'd
shake them off the plant, and you'd be running that tube along and chasing bugs and sucking at the same time.
We were like little vacuum cleaners, sort of human vacuum cleaners.
Yeah. So if you want to call and join our conversation, you can today. The numbers are 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 217-333-9455 and 800-222-9455. We're talking with Joe Spencer and Michael Jeffords and Susan Post. The last two have just finished authoring a book called Biologist in the Field, Stories, Tales, and Anecdotes from 150 Years of Field Biology. And one of the writers for our authors, I suppose, for that has been Joe Spencer. Joe, I asked you to look up something a little bit earlier. Did you find what I was looking for?
I found it.
All right.
I found it.
Please read that.
Okay. This is from a piece called Getting High with the Beatles, which is all about how we decided to catch insects on towers. I'll just read a little bit here. The humid evening was drawing to a close. A distant line of trees had failed in a good attempt to tangle the sun in their branches and extend the day, and the sun slipped out of sight. I recall how the dew had begun to accumulate on the soybean leaves and on the rootworm beetles long before the sun had escaped. Once beetles are clothed in dewy cloaks, they do not fly, and it's time to go home. We were leaning against our vehicles, reviewing what we'd observed, and pausing to regard the brilliant orange fingers of sunset that were rapidly pulling the gun-blue sky over us. A shared frustration occurred as we noted that many beetles that flew above our heads, sometimes even arcing upward and lifting out of sight and out of our reach. This was a common complaint at the end of the day, insects that we couldn't really get to. This evening, Scott suggested that we should not put up with that anymore. Let's build towers. I think I laughed, but asked what he meant. Towers, scaffolding towers that will put us up there where the beetles are flying. Like a platform, I asked? Yeah, like a tower 10 meters above the canopy.
So now you understand why I kind of thought about this as poetry some because there, and it's just not Joe that writes so very well. It's many of you that write so very well, and it just makes it wonderful to read. We're joined now by a couple of callers on line one. We have somebody who'd like to get into this conversation this morning. Good morning to you from Champaign in line one.
Yes, good morning. I have some comments about the Cache River. And I was very interested in our scientists' comments about the Cache River. My husband and I first actually learned about the Cache River Preserve when we joined the Nature Conservancy. And they are very active in preservation of the Cache River area. And so we decided one summer to take a trip through southern Illinois. Of course, we went to Garden of the Gods and all that. But we went down to the Cache River, and it was just an amazing place because it is an ancient Tupelo swamp was the area we went to. And I guess the trees there are 1,000 years old. And when we walked out onto a boardwalk into the swamp surrounded by these enormous trees, it was like being transported to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then it hit me that southern Illinois is on the same, was it latitude with Norfolk, Virginia?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's really southern. And those tupelo trees are so beautiful. And the stillness of the place, we hear the birds and all of the other critters. And I can't identify a prothamatory warbler, but just looking up into the trees, you can see birds everywhere and warblers. I'm not sure what I saw, but I saw warblers mm-hmm. of some sort. And the place was just wonderful. We had a feeling of timelessness. And I really, really hope that money is available to preserve this place forever the way it should be, because it is an historic treasure and something that I think people in the state of Illinois really don't know about. And then we had a Thoreauian moment where we were walking along the boardwalk through the swamp and a train went through in the distance. And it reminded me of Thoreau at Walden Pond, you know, where his reverie in nature, you know, was interrupted by the sound of the train in the distance. But, for anybody who is taking a vacation in southern Illinois, I definitely recommend going to the Cache River Preserve. It is just really an amazing place.
Yes, a couple of other comments. I don't know if you went to see what we call the Winnie the Pooh trees. There were cypress trees from 1,000 to 1,500 years old. They're 170 feet tall, and the largest one is 43 feet around
its base. Yes, you can see those.
Yes.
Oh, I missed those while I was there. I wish I'd seen them.
Yep.
I took a canoe trip through the cache, and that was that was a ride on its own, but because we had, well, 20,
a couple years ago, we took we led a tour from local people who know as little bit about it as some of the other people in Illinois. We took some people from Mounds, which is probably 15 miles down the road, and the first word out of this gentleman's mouth was he was a preacher, and he says I thought there were no cathedrals in southern Illinois.
You know, I went with actually the architecture students,
and
we went to well, I went to report on the architecture students here on campus, but they were on a mission to see the Cache River and how important the environment was in this case. It was, you know, to clear water and the swamp and the availability of that swamp in southern Illinois and what it did for the environment, but how important the environment was to the grand scheme of things when in the future they would be putting buildings up mm-hmm. and destroying some of these things in that process, but how to try to salvage them. And it was really a magnificent day. The canoe trip was kind of fun. We had 50 pounds of, there were three of us in the canoe, and Steve Parker, who is the videographer with me, and we can tell tales on him a bit later, was sitting in the center on the bar with about 25 pounds of television, you know, 25 pounds and $20,000 of television camera on his shoulder as we made our way through that very still swamp. Thanks to our caller from line one in Champaign, somebody from Urbana as on line two and has been waiting. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
You have a question or a comment?
Well, I actually have both. Like previous caller, my first exposure to the Cache River Heron Pond area was via the Nature Conservancy. Saw it headline front page on one of their quarterly issues magazines, and I was clueless that existed in Illinois. A short time later, I went down on a field trip to Heron Pond with the Nature Conservancy. It was led by, I believe it was Clem Markham, quite a character, him and his kids. On a great trip through the Heron Pond, one comment is anyone going down there, do take plenty of insect repellent. Mosquitoes can be very hungry. And the fish in the stream along the trail going back to the Heron Pond Boardwalk are quite interesting to look at also. Some quite unusual fish that I don't see up here in the Urbana area. And also, are any of your guests, I assume they've all experienced this multiple times, but the three or four times I've been in southern Illinois on vacation, at night when it rains, and frogs are just going across the roads like crazy, and you just have to be really careful not to be squashing these frogs. I can see where the term raining frogs came from.
Yeah, I mean, particularly in springtime, what happens is, you know, the ground cools down and the road doesn't, and the frogs end up, you know, walking across, sitting on the pavement and so forth. And there are a lot of roads that bisect pristine, pretty good habitat, you know, so organisms end up on the roads. One of the big issues down there is roadkill, reptiles and amphibians. So it's something that you need to be cognizant of. And, you know, drive around and enjoy the place. Don't go zipping through.
But that never seems to happen, raining frogs, when we happen to have our reptile and amphibian class down there in southern Illinois, because we seem to have to search for everything we need.
Rainfall, that's one of those things that you have to deal with on a daily basis as a field biologist. And I don't remember which story it was, but there's a story, and I want to call them spelunkers. They were I don't remember what they were looking for.
Yes.
Speaking of rain, can you tell a little bit about that?
We have one of the world authority on cave fauna at the survey, and he elicits others along to help, and they were in a cave down in southwestern Illinois, and you know, and their experience. Well, the two people were experienced, and they had an entomologist along. He wasn't quite so experienced, and it was a kind of a blustery day, you know, and they were looking around, and I said, well, should we go down? Should we not go down? And they decided to go down, you know, it's caves in all are not pleasant places. You know, you're muddy, you're wet, you're crawling, the caves in all are very wet. So they were in, and all of a sudden they began to hear they weren't far enough in that they couldn't hear the thunder beginning to rumble. And, you know, when you're in a cave and they're groundwater fed, you know, and there are dissolution caves and there are streams running through them, you know, and a couple of places were really tight where they actually had to do dips where they went through the water, you know, with just your head out of the water. And after a while, you know, they looked around and all of a sudden the water's not clear anymore. It's beginning to get muddy and they're looking around and they're like, perhaps we should leave, you know. So the stories about them wending their way back out, it wasn't close to life-threatening, but it had the potential to be. And when they got out, they were, let's just say they were extremely happy to, because there was it had been a major storm had gone through, tornado, there were trees down. I mean, the above ground was just a mess driving around. And here they were in this potentially lethal situation underground. But which brings me to the point of field biology in general. One thing that field biologists are is they're passionate about their work. We love what we're doing, and we will do anything on earth to get the data, to get the information, up to and including risking life and limb. And I have just a little excerpt from Forbes, which sort of epitomizes that, if I can read that.
You bet.
Havana, Illinois, November 1st, 1877. This is a letter that Stephen Forbes wrote to his wife, Clara, and I'm just going to read excerpts of it. He says, "Sitting on a dry goods box in a fisherman's boat, I measured the bodies and head and eyes and fins of buffalo fish, and counted their fin rays and scales and entered the notes in my book for over 2 hours. Then followed decapitation, evisceration, and labeling and bottling and noting down again and again. And then, worst of all, dinner. A fine table beside which your man's appetite found impracticable. Coffee in bowls with brown sugar and without milk, gray heavy bread, but very good butter." And then the last sentence is, "So I came in with my hands smarting, my arms half paralyzed with cold, my feet wet, but full once more of the old enthusiasm that never is found in museum rooms, nor even my lady's chamber." Stephen, I'm not sure I would have said that last sentence to my wife, but it shows you the absolute dedication and passion of these people.
Yeah, and that he liked food, too.
And he liked food. He liked to eat.
And speaking of which, I think our listener on line two from Champaign may have one extra thing he'd like to talk about.
Okay.
Is that right, listener? You have someplace we should go
that
eat?
That is correct. The Root Beer Saloon in Alto Pass.
Oh, Alto Pass, home of a good vineyard.
I know where it is.
Oh, yeah. It's got the vineyard there and the Root Beer Saloon. It's got a... just a very unique place. It's got an eclectic menu, anything from Cajun crawfish to peanut butter and jelly or salmon or pastas. The guy is one of the owners is a taxidermist, so there's lots of neat animals. He's also a motorcycle enthusiast, so he's got his favorite motorcycle there roped off in the main area, the eating area, and they've got beans and pastas imported from all over Italy and that. And he's also a musician and a music enthusiast, so there's guitars in there. They've got a 19th century wooden bar with a 9-foot python skin on it. And there's chocolates from Dixon Springs.
You've only spent a little time there, apparently.
Chocolate you wouldn't think would go together, but it does.
Oh.
That must be the chocolate factory over by Dixon Springs.
Yeah, we can attest to the chocolate factory.
That's an excellent place, too.
Yeah, three root beers on tap, different varieties, cream soda on tap. And the owners are just fascinating to talk with. The guy's also got a little lumber mill. So.
Oh, that's
fun. Inherited from the family.
Well, thank you for joining our conversation today. We sure are glad that you stayed with us for a while. Thanks much to our listener on line two. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can. The numbers to call are 217-333-9455. That's WILL. Or 1-800-222-9455 if you'd like to call us toll-free. I likened the book and being a field biologist. He mentioned motorcycles I ride or have in the past. And it's about the ride and the tales after the fact. That's really the fun part. And sometimes the ride can be really tough, and I guess that's your part in the day, or as the case may be, if you happen to be Michael Jeffords and you're trucking your way across, I guess, Eastern Europe, or maybe you were in Portugal at the time. Maybe it was Portugal you were in at the time?
Well, we were in the mid-80s. We went to Europe to look for pathogens or diseases of gypsy moth. So we started in Portugal, and we would end up in Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia then was intact. You know, it was before all the really bad things happened in Yugoslavia. So we finished up our field work in Portugal, which was basically cutting open caterpillars, a la Joe here. You know, thousands of them, looking for diseases.
It's all about what's in the gut all the time, isn't it?
It's all about food.
And then we were supposed to fly to Belgrade, and then my colleague, who was Joe Maddox, said, well, why don't we take a train? That sounds much more romantic, you know. And I said, well, you know, how far can it be from Lisbon to Belgrade? Well, turns out it can be really far. and we went to the train station to buy our tickets, and Joe had agreed to learn Portuguese, and I learned Serbo-Croatian, sort of, to get by. So Joe proceeded to buy us two first-class tickets on a train that was to go from Lisbon to Belgrade, Yugoslavia. And the agent asked him a question, which we didn't know the significance of. He said, do you want to go the fast way or the shortest way? And Joe said, well, of course, the shortest way. And he said, okay, you know, so, which was a poor choice. So we got on the train, and we had our luggage, you know, and it was a pretty small train. I thought, this is a very scenic. It wasn't the Orient Express, you know, but it was significant. And everybody that got on the train had bags of food. We thought, oh, this is very charming because the local people are using this as a market run, you know, and it'll get off along the way. Well, it turned out that Joe had purchased a first-class ticket on a third-class train, which means it went very slow. It had no food cars. And these people had bought food for this 5-day trip.
You thought they were selling the food.
We thought they were selling or buying it, you know. So, you know, 2 days into the trip, Joe and I have not eaten, you know, and we're sitting there, and we began. Finally, the train did stop in Marseille, and the guy said, well, yeah, you can hop off the train. Got off the train in Marseille, and we finally had a meal, and we got back on, and then it was three more days, and we were coming through Italy, and we pretty much had it, you know. We smoking. Everybody in Europe smokes, and everybody just smokes to make smoke, it seemed to me like. So we were in these cars, and it was a priest and two nuns and on the family, and everybody was smoking. I was, you know, pretty much half dead at the time. So we stopped in Venice and had a lovely weekend in Venice. So we hopped out of the train. If you've ever been to Venice, the train station ends on the Grand Canal. There are no, and then it backs out of town, kind of like in Chicago. So we got out of in Venice. The first time we walked out, it was on a Friday night. There were probably 5,000 Hare Krishna devotees dancing along and walking along the Grand Canal, chanting and singing. And we're like, oh, God, you know, what have we done here? But it was, it turned out to be a very nice weekend, you know, and we kind of got our bearings back. And then we finally ended up in Belgrade six days after leaving Lisbon.
And how many days did you go out without food in the process?
We went 2.5 days in one and then almost 2 days the other direction.
It was... Yeah, did you beat Maddox after that?
Well, I wrote about him in the book several times, you know. And
I think there's a couple Joe Maddox stories.
There's several Joe Maddox stories in there. And Joe is a very, very elegant, very sophisticated Southern gentleman, very polite, you know. And just don't let him buy your train tickets.
But funny things always happen to Joe.
And yeah, there's a story in here about Joe in Central America where he actually caught a moth with his ear. He got a moth lodged in his ear, and the people had to take him to the local doctor to dislodge this moth from his ear.
Oh.
Yeah, painful. I mean,
Oh, man.
Kind of like a Twilight Zone kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, pretty much. He was dancing around, they were at a fire, and they were black lighting for insects, you know, collecting insects at lights, and there was a fire there. And all of a sudden, everybody saw Joe dancing around on 1 foot, banging on his one ear, and you know, they thought he was doing some kind of ritual dance kind of thing.
Oh, there's a scene from a movie called Mountains of the Moon. I don't know whether you've seen this movie. It's about the scientist from England and their trips through Africa, and he had gotten a bug in his ear, but they poured hot wax in it to kill it, and of course, he lost his hearing, but I guess Joe had better luck than that.
They poured alcohol in it and then pulled it out with a, you know.
So. Oh, okay.
Yeah, not very pleasant.
Not very pleasant. Somebody from from Champaign is on line one with us this morning to talk to you. Good morning to you again from line one in Champaign.
Hi. I've seen some of the materials that the survey is pulling together for the 150th, and one of those was a timeline that had been developed of the significant times during the Natural History Survey's history. And I wanted to ask Sue Post if she had any particular insights or stories or things that particularly impressed her when she was developing this timeline on the history of the survey. And thank you. I'll listen on air.
No, great question. Thank you for asking it.
I have to thank Kathy Bileski, our administrative secretary, because she saw a timeline of LAS's, Liberal Arts and Sciences, on their website. And she said, oh, wouldn't it be nice if the Natural History Survey had a timeline? I took it upon myself and started delving into the history of the Natural History Survey. And we have this 10-page document that's free if you come by the Natural History Survey. And it does have significant dates in the history and events in the history of the Natural History Survey. Some of the most, I mean, there's just so much that I learned. I mean, the Natural History Survey was a powerhouse in gladiola research at one time.
Hmm.
We had a significant, a lot of our research was published and helped Rachel Carson for Silent Spring. And another one I find interesting was William Cochrane. He was a wildlife specialist and engineer with the Natural History Survey, and he designed a radio transmitter in 1965, small enough for songbirds. For the next 39 years, he would track an assortment of birds, mainly thrushes, over 30,000 miles. This same gentleman in 1983 designed a solar transmitter to be used and tracked California condors. So it's amazing what survey scientists and the influence they've had just on natural history research.
I think it's touted as one of the best natural history surveys in the nation. Is that right?
It's the largest, second oldest, and certainly the most extensive. And as a member of it, I will say yes, by far.
You're not biased at all.
But by far the most significant, yes.
And we haven't talked much about that because, again, this afternoon we'll take that topic up.
Mm-hmm.
During
right.
our 1 o'clock hour, we'll talk more about the 150th anniversary. And, yes, I would love to. I have not seen the timeline, so we'll take up that this afternoon as well. Sue, when I took a look at the book, of course, I was drawn first to the very one story in the book that has my name on it. But it's not about me, of course.
No.
Gleaning from Gleason, but it may give some context to the history of the Natural History Survey and the kinds of things that field biologists have done for decades here in this great state of ours.
Henry Allen Gleason has sort of been – Henry Allen Gleason was a botanist. He lived here in Champaign-Urbana, sort of one of my heroes because I really like the nature preserve named after him, the Henry Allen Gleason Nature Preserve. It's a sand prairie. And he was an extensive writer and journal keeper. And the Natural History Survey was lucky enough to have some of his notes. And I was able to, in my gleanings, what I call them, I have notes from his visits to the sand prairie area that later became a nature preserve named after him. He went in 1901 and again in 1904. And the gleanings just talk about some of the things they did. And earlier, Todd and I were talking about how Gleason at the time was about 22, and they did all their work. They walked. They would take the train. The train would deposit them. And then they would walk to all their sites. And sometimes that would be anywhere from 5 to 6 miles. And a fun activity for them would then to be swimming in the Illinois River at night to cool down. And like we had mentioned earlier about ice cream,
mm-hmm.
ice cream played an important part because one of the colleague that usually went with Gleason, his name was Charles Hart. And something that Hart wanted to do was to write sort of a guide to the ice cream parlors of Illinois because they always had an ice cream soda. And it was like, which one would have the best ice cream soda? So, you know, you'd have to have a couple every night.
Yeah, he wrote a story about that, which was that anytime they went to a new place, and at that time there would be more than usually one
yeah.
ice cream soda shop in town, even in the small communities, and they'd hit all of them the first night and decide which one was the best one, and that would be where they would probably eat supper. I think most of those nights it appeared that he liked ice cream a whole lot. Of course, he was only 22, so maybe he changed over time on that one. Just another interesting little tidbit. And there was something I found of interest in there. I'm afraid I don't know how to pronounce or what even the name of this plant might be in my terms, but they were looking on the sand dunes and they had found a plant there.
Lescarella spathulata.
Yeah. Do we have a common name for that one at all?
Silvery bladder pod, which is not much better than Lescarella spathulata.
But it still blooms there in May, so it's still there. You can still go see
it. It's a western species discovered by Gleason in this blowout on this one sand dune in Henry Allen Gleason. He discovered it in 1906. He went back again in 1975 or 76, saw it again, and if you go there in April, May, today, you can still see it.
Mm-hmm.
It's still there.
It's an odd plant for a sand dune in
hundreds
Illinois.
It's hundreds of miles west or east of where it should be because of the microhabitat. But yeah. It was discovered by Gleason, and that population still exists.
I think that
historical botany.
Yeah, and he theorized that it probably had been there for thousands of years.
And it's, yeah, so if anybody would like to go, it's not a spectacular plant, but you know, you go there and you say, yeah, Gleason looked at the same population, which is very cool.
Yeah, so the timeline, again, you can follow that timeline right on through history. It's
mm-hmm.
interesting stuff. If you'd like to join our timeline for the next, I don't know, 6-7 minutes or so, you can do that this afternoon, rather this morning. The phone number locally is 217-333-9455, 800-222-9455. Joe Spencer, is there anything you didn't write about that you wish you had of now and put it in this book for when we get to act to a biologist in the field?
Well, there actually are a couple of things. I had a very interesting phone call a few months back from a person who felt very strongly that they had some insects living in their skin. And it was very, very interesting realizing that this person had a disorder, and I was cognizant of trying to be sympathetic to them, but also trying to draw on what I knew to offer some advice, and realizing I didn't have a whole lot of advice to offer, but it was very interesting, very interesting.
It's been, Joe and I, our offices are right next to each other, and Mike and I have been really involved with the book as editors along with Charlie Warwick. So we've read these stories over and over and over again. But this is the first time that Joe has read other than what he's written in the book. And it's been interesting, you know, I'll say, Joe, did you read the one about the squirrel? No. Did you read the one about this? And he's like, no. And then he'll come back the next day. I read the one.
Yeah.
I read the canoe one.
The electric canoe.
Electric canoe is, oh, it's probably one of the best.
Oh, that one
written.
I missed.
Oh,
fantastic.
It's very good.
What is it?
I don't want to spoil it for you.
Oh, well, okay. Electric Canoe. You'll need to get hold of the book. How do you get hold of the book, by the way? We've talked about it most of the hour.
It's available. We just got it from the printer. It's available from the Illinois Natural History Survey. You can come by. It's available on our website. You can call, and we'll ship you one. 333-6830 is a phone number, and it'll be available this weekend for sale at our expo and so forth. So. It's now out, and we're going to try to get it in the bookstores, Pages and the other places in town. So
it's really fun just because you don't have to read it all. Actually, it's probably best not consumed all in
right.
one fell swoop. That you can it's laid out in some sort of orderly fashion, and you can pick a title that you like. Let me just read some titles. So you've got chapter one doing the work, and then each of the chapters is divided into little tidbits. So first responder, the summer of our discontent, a net full of bats and more, the do's and don'ts of research. You got a dead one. I didn't read that one, but and Adventures in Nighttime Electric Shocking. That was kind of interesting. I read that one. And Newton Lake. These are, but it's really simple to pick it up and read just a little bit. It takes sometimes 30 seconds and sometimes a few minutes to read.
One thing that shocked me about our staff when I got this stuff is how poetic they can be.
I know.
And can I read just a little bit?
Right.
It's called The Mind of a Botanist, The Words of a Poet. And it's by Connie Cunningham, who's a field botanist. I'll just read the beginning stanza and the ending stanza.
Okay.
It says, maddening mosquitoes, stinging nettle, chiggers, ticks, and poison ivy, multiflora rose, all sharp honey suck, honey locust thorns, weltering, sultry, stifling heat, field work. And in the last stanza, solitude, gratitude, wonder, belonging, peace, field work.
You know, and not only do they write like that for the book, but sometimes they write like that in their daily journals,
right?
Too, I think,
because we can't do it in our scientific papers. I mean, if you write something like that, it's going to get edited out.
I think one of them I saw in one of the journals was about rain, and I don't remember which one I read, but it was
Steve Hill.
Maybe you can find it, but I do recall reading it. It was kind of funny. It was just he was waiting for it to rain and was hoping that it wouldn't, and eventually it did, I guess. But he made journal notes about that, and if you don't find it, that's okay.
I got it.
Oh, okay.
It says, written in field notes, August 18th, 2005, along the Fox River, Northern Illinois. I hope it doesn't rain. I hope it doesn't rain too hard. I hope it doesn't rain too long. Please let it stop soon. Oh, well, back to work. I'm soaked anyway.
that's pretty good
from
description.
From his field notes. I mean, it's pretty incredible.
It's a pretty good description. Field biologist, what's it like? I know what it's like in one of your days sometimes, but what's it like out there in the field?
It can be incredibly miserable. I mean, this is a hot, humid, buggy, stinging place, field work is redundant. It's research means redoing things over and over again, and we all love it.
And I think the book kind of highlights that when you go around the state, there's a lot of large and small miracles you can find throughout Illinois. And we've had the luxury of studying them, and hopefully we can communicate some of that to our enthusiasm to the public.
I get the pleasure of seeing Joe come back from his corn field work every day because he walks right by my office. You know, and he goes out really happy and cheery, and he comes back really happy and cheery and dirty.
And dirty.
Just
yeah.
dirtier.
And a lot dirtier. I've been on a couple of those runs. You did not get Mike Gray and Kevin Steffi, who my regular listeners in the mm-hmm. afternoon for the Closing Market Report will know is entomologists and that write a great deal. You didn't get them to write stories for this, and I wish
wouldn't.
You had.
We'll
put some pressure on
for the volume two. Yes.
So I've got a story on Mike that I have to tell. We were out on the Western Corn Rootworm. That little bug actually has a lot of good stories that go along with it, but we were along the Illinois-Indiana border, and I was out with Mike, and we were digging roots that day. And I produced a video story I call A Day in the Life of Mike Gray, or entomologist in this case. And we're, I don't know, halfway through the morning or something, and you're walking through the fields, and you stop every 100 feet or something like that, and he would take a spade and dig up a root mass and put it into a wheelbarrow, which he's pushing up and down the rows of these fields. And we came out, and he was standing there at the end of the pickup truck, and Mike's kind of tall, and he's leaning up against that truck, and the person that was with him, I said she was going to get a drink of water, and he looked right at the camera, and it was running. And he says, you know, I think I'm going to hold off just a bit on that because I think it'll make my beer taste a lot better later in the day. And it wasn't more than an hour later, Mike's got his head underneath the water, and it's running, and he's trying to keep from going down from heat stroke. So maybe we can get him to write that one, too. Well, to all of you, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Oh, thank you.
All right. That's Michael Jeppards and Sue Post and Joe Spencer, all entomologists and part of the Illinois Natural History Survey. And the first two have authored, in part with a whole bunch of help from other biologists. Biologists in the Field, Stories, Tales, and Anecdotes from 150 Years of Field Biology. You've been listening to the first hour of Focus 580. I'm Todd Gleason.